Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this morning's session, which is focusing very much on trends in the alternative asset classes market. What we mean by that is, of course, build-to-rent, retirement living, care homes, as well as student accommodation. One could also add a number of other interests, obviously, like logistics, etc. But given the composition of our panel, that's going to be the focus of today. My name is Deepa Debrattray, and I'm a partner in the property group at Bowen Leighton Paisner. And my practice focuses very much on residential-led mixed-use development as well as student accommodation. Post-Brexit, Trump, and the mayhem created by our recent snap election, certainly at BLP we have seen increased focus by investors looking to diversify their portfolios and looking very much at these alternative asset classes. Joining me on the panel today to discuss whether these trends will continue and what the potential challenges and opportunities may be are Nigel Welby, who people may know as being the chairman of Retirement Villages PLC. Nigel will focus, obviously, on retirement living and care homes. Philip Hillman, who is the chairman of the UK alternatives team at JLL. And for those of us involved in student accommodation deals, we'll know that in the last decade, there hasn't been a deal done that Philip and his team have not been involved in. And last, but by no means least, Graham Alfie Cook, who is the Managing Director of Development at Lloyds Bank. And Graham will be giving his view from a lender perspective. So thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us this morning. Nigel, if I could start with you. Do you agree that there is increased focus on retirement living and care homes?
I do agree, which is probably just as well, since we're all sitting here wanting to talk about it. For investors, what drives investors at the moment is a search for yield. It's very difficult to find any yield anywhere with safety. And in our retirement sector, of course, that return is backed by the huge demand that arises from the aging demographic. And there's virtually no supply to meet that demand. If I can put some flesh on that with a few statistics, because it's still early enough in the day for statistics. ONS statistics over the 10-year period we're in, so we're talking about today, from 2014 to 2024, the number of 16 to 64-year-olds will rise by 2.6%, whereas the number of over 64-year-olds will rise by 22.4%. So that by 2025, which is only 8 years away, over 20% of the UK population will be over 65. So there's this massive increase that we all know about. And they're wealthy. Those over 65s, there are various estimates. JLL here are very modest. They talk about 800 billion. There are other specialists who say it's well over a trillion of equity in their homes that they have available to spend, and they are willing to spend on their old age and on their care. More importantly, I think, if you look at the over 85 group, that age cohort is increasing by over 500% in the 50 years between 85 and 2034. And the reason for that, of course, is that once upon a time, you grew old, you grew ill, and then you did the decent thing and died. But that doesn't happen anymore. You grow old, you get ill, and now you linger because of the wonders of science for years and years. But that's the business opportunity. We're here to help people linger and take their money and provide them with wonderful housing and a great lifestyle, and I strongly recommend it. If I can be serious, just to take one example of that, which is dementia. At the moment, 1 in 100 people over 65 will suffer from dementia. But if you take the people over 80, it's actually 1 in 6. And the Alzheimer's Society estimate that number will double by 2051. So unless somebody creates a pill to solve these terrible long-term illnesses, we do need to create a society with the housing, with the care, the facilities and the services to look after them. Now, So the demand is there, but what's the investment case? My personal business has always been commercial property investment, and we moved into the retirement housing sector in 2005 with our first retirement village. We've now got 14 with another 8 in the pipeline. And what motivated us, I end where I started, is this search for yield. And a steady, repeatable, reliable income flow. Once you've finished the initial development, you then have income streams from ground rents, from what we call event fees, which is a fee we charge every time the unit changes hands, typically 10 to 12% of the value of the house. And of course from the care incomes. So the property incomes and the care income streams downstream are totally reliable. There's no covenant risk because our residents with certainty will die and we will get these incomes. So it's a terrific business. I'm struggling to turn the page to tell you that in this country 0.6% of total housing supply is occupied by people who need care. Compare that to developed markets of Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, United States. It's typically over 7% of housing is occupied, is specialist housing for retired people with care. So the opportunity is massive and we haven't even begun to satisfy it.
Thank you, Nigel. Philip, what about from the student perspective, the other end of the spectrum? Do you agree that investors are looking for long-term stabilised income and will trade yields?
Many of them are looking for long-term income, but I think there's also opportunities for different risk levels in the student sector, depending on what sort of returns you're seeking. Direct let student accommodation, which is where there's no overriding lease to a university, can give you a higher yield perhaps than your secure leased to a university type of accommodation. But in reality, you know, there is quite a range of opportunities out there. You know, prime yield for direct let student housing in central London is probably about 4.5% net initial. If you're in the provinces, it might be sort of 5.5% or thereabouts. If you've got a lease to a university for, say, 25, 30 years or more, you might have a net initial of 3.5%. Which clearly would be a very attractive to the legal and generals of this world and the pension funds. As a sector, I think it's, we've seen it evolve enormously over the last 20, 25 years since I've been involved. The first decade of my involvement in the 90s, there were hardly any transactions. It was just land sales. And as valuers then, we were trying to guess where yields should be. And we knew it wasn't residential. We knew it wasn't commercial. And we started talking about student housing as a sector in its own right, and a lot of people were very sniffy about it and very cynical. Bizarrely, I've actually spent the last 5 or 10 years trying to suggest to people to think of it actually more as rented residential, but a specialist type of residential. If I was an American, I'd be talking about multifamily, and our colleagues over in the States will be covering, a wide range of asset classes within that multifamily, and they'd include student in it, not bat an eyelid. Over here, I do think the relationship between build-to-rent and student housing is worth keeping a close eye on. Student housing isn't perhaps quite as alternative as it used to be, with transaction volumes 2015 at about 5.5 billion in the UK, 2016 at about 3.4 billion. This year, we were saying we thought it would probably be about 3 billion. Actually, by the end of this year, it'll probably be 5.5 billion, if not closed, then certainly pending. So transaction levels are still really high there at the moment. But this relationship with PRS is quite interesting. In mainland Europe, where a lot of people are pioneering student housing, development of scale, in fairly nascent sectors, markets, we've got yields there that in Germany are keener than quite a lot of the UK student housing yields, even though it's a relatively new sector. And that's because of the relationship between student housing and the residential to let market. There you can hop over between residential and student housing without needing planning consent. And also they have a much more mature build to rent market. Over here, if you're looking at where student yields are, typically You know, there's still that margin between whatever the build-to-rent yields are, 3.5%, 4% or whatever, in London, and comparing that to the student yields of 4.5% to 5.5%. If you are looking at sort of the whole of Europe and opportunities, some people take a view that there is potential for yield compression because the difference between student yields and PRS yields is too great. Ultimately, I think as the build-to-rent, as I should call it, market becomes more established here, I think there's potential for student yields to be seen and lumped together more closely with where those build-to-rent yields are. We'll have to see. But certainly investors at the moment can't get enough of the student housing market, despite the headwinds of Brexit, international student numbers, a little bit of uncertainty about what will happen to European students being recruited by universities. But it's all happening in the context of a very fast-growing global international student market. The numbers of international students are growing very rapidly, the growing middle classes in India and China. And even though UK might lose market share, it's losing market share in an area that is growing very fast. So, yeah, a pretty positive outlook.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip. And Graham, from a lender perspective, Where have you seen most of the activity in recent times?
In terms of alternative asset classes.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously plenty of activity going on in the mainstream asset classes. I think, and I'm going to try and focus on London here because, of course, we have a UK-wide footprint and lots of activity across the UK, across the alternative asset classes. But certainly, if I think about student PRS, I'm going to extend it as well. PRS, we'll call it built to rent, whatever the definition is. But also micro-living, which is where we're seeing more activity. And also more innovative, if you like, line stretching of the PRS-type product, where you'll have larger social amenity areas and smaller accommodation areas, so characterized by the likes of the collectives product, for example. If I think about where we have been active and where we've been partnering with other banks, well, I know Canary Wharf were on a stand yesterday and on a panel yesterday. Well, they have a couple of PRS buildings in the Woodwharf development. Well, we're supporting those. Similarly, the Newfoundland Tower, which is going up in the western end of the dock down at Canary Wharf, we're supporting them with that. We have supported Quintain previously up in Wembley, delivered PRS there. So, you know, that's just three London-based examples. More recently, we did the pure PRS deal up in Birmingham, as I said. I'll talk about London. For the student side of things, it's interesting. It's more difficult to get the development product going in London. Certainly, we've supported regional development on the student side of things, Select, for example, through their Vita student brand, most recently last year. We have undertaken some transactions on the investment side of things within the London marketplace. So we certainly, a bit of way, but we helped Unite with their secured group structure. And then more latterly, the Nido Greystar transaction. So there's been quite a lot of activity there. Moving on to micro living, which is interesting. And I mean, if you were listening to Jules Pipe this morning talking about the population growth in London and the affordability conundrum that we actually have, we've been working very closely with Pocket Living, which is actually supported by the GLA. And Pocket provides, Their product is micro apartments, so typically around about the 400 square foot size of things. It has to be sold at 80% less local market value, so it makes it genuinely affordable to key workers within London. So we signed a £45 million loan agreement with them last year. Related Inc. of the US has actually come in and taken a 50% equity stake in them. So that's an example of the interest, if you like, coming over from across the pond into the UK marketplace. So look, we will continue to support those entities. I've already mentioned the collective. If you want me to talk about the areas and where we're seeing the activity, and again, just chiming with the conundrum of where we actually provide this living accommodation, where developers provide the living accommodation, and where they are, where the most activity seems to be. You know, Central London, yeah, it's expensive. There's not a huge amount of activity going on. If it is, it's in the higher end. If you look out, you know, north, so Tottenham Hill, for example, Brent Cross, east, out towards Silvertown, west, Old Oak Common and other areas, Acton, for example, we're seeing a lot of, having a lot of client dialogue with, to discuss how we can support them deliver those transactions.
Thank you. So lots of activity. Yeah. Philip, if I may ask you, how do you think the alternatives, but I suppose specifically student market, is responding to the snap election results?
Well, last year, alternatives formed about 29% of all commercial transactions in the UK. Student housing was the dominant piece of the action there. I think most people are looking at alternatives as a relatively defensive investment sector. In uncertain times, they're trying to avoid the fluctuations of normal market conditions and boom and bust. They're looking at sectors that are driven perhaps more by demographics, certainly in the healthcare, senior living, healthcare side, students, certainly. You know, people, there'll always be some fluctuations in people that, you know, how many people go to university. But fundamentally, on the whole, people, when it's their time to go to university, they go, even if the fees are an extortionate £9,000 a year or more. So actually, you know, we are finding certainly, you know, we've got transactions going underway at the moment. We've got about 1.5 billion of student housing transactions underway that we're handling. And nobody has said, oh, you know what, we'll just leave that. No way. They're actually very, very keen to get into student and the other alternative sectors because they're seeing them as, you know, relatively secure and stable. Student housing during the recession, you know, during the global financial crisis, was hit far less than other asset classes. And, of course, you could argue it's contracyclical because actually more people tend to go to university in a recession. In terms of driving investment returns, at the moment, when we take portfolios to market, the portfolios typically might be anything from 300 to 500 or £600 million. Of purpose-built accommodation. Now, we're normally getting 10 or so bidders through to the final stages of that. So there's still a lot of unsatisfied demand. There's a lot of new investors, particularly from the Far East, who have yet to make their first move into the sector. We've had a market that was dominated by the North Americans in 2014-15, but now is a much more global market. And certainly when we're taking anything to market now, we've got to make sure it's fully exposed to those global investors. So one client was looking at selling a portfolio that they've invested in. It's over £500 million worth. And their main worry about selling it is, what are we going to reinvest in? The reinvestment risk. Because they actually can't really see anything that suits them much better with their criteria than student. Now, they will actually sell that portfolio, but they're going to buy more student in due course. So I think that reinvestment risk is a serious one. And although, as I say, you know, it's not all rosy out there, there are some headwinds. You've got to make sure you're in the right locations, you're with the right universities. I think a lot of universities are going to be marginalised as they lose international students, perhaps some of them, particularly the ones that never really had that big international appeal. So I think, you know, one's got to be very careful and selective about location. But on the whole, you know, the latest June surprise that we've just had, and last year's June, was it June surprise of Brexit? You know, we're almost getting used to the uncertainty now. I think actually it's making them pile into alternatives. I don't know what others think, but nice. We're seeing quite, if anything, a positive response to it.
Interesting. And Nigel, does the same apply for retirement living?
I mean, it does. As Philip said, we're driven by need. If people are ill, they've got to be cared for. And Brexit really isn't going to change that at all. But I also agree very much with your point about what do you do with the money. As commercial property investors, we were buying institutional-grade commercial property investments after Lehman Brothers went bust, when there was a run on the retail funds, you may remember. Yields of about 8.5%, and we've been recently selling all of those at yields around the 5% mark. We've been putting that cash into the retirement village business because although there's a development risk,
which is horrible. I mean, nobody in their right mind would ever do development, but we don't judge it to be a risk because of the level of demand to buy the products we're creating. So Brexit hasn't really affected that. I think where it's helped us is that we have identified an increase in the number of telephone calls we're receiving from overseas investors, because the drop in the value of sterling has certainly, I think, made what we're doing more profitable for overseas investors.
Yeah. And so, Graham, from your perspective on the lender side and lender appetite, what is it that you what is it that you'd like to focus on in the world of alternatives?
Well, I mean, I think the fundamentals have just been mentioned. I'm not quite sure I agree with the comment about and be mad to go into development because that's my core business, but never mind. But, you know, yes, it is things like sponsor, it is location, product, making sure you can be convinced with that. I'd also like to touch upon the investor appetite, which is interesting. I mean, I had a chat with our capital markets colleagues before coming over, and, you know, as far as they're concerned, you know, there is a very strong institutional bid out there for, you know, good product, well-structured product, and that remains. So I think, you know, we're very mindful as we help our clients deliver, you know, on the development phase, then into the investment phase, across the range of these assets. If they're being held and they're being managed on a long-term basis, then there's a lot of investors out there looking for yield. We, you know, we see a lot of, indeed, competition for the pure development finance product from the institutional funds who'll say, do you know, we like the story so much, we'll just provide the whole check, and we'll, you know, we'll take it through the development and into the investment phase. Thanks very much. We recognise that. We compete with that. We have a nascent Scottish Widows forward funding product that we are working through with a number of clients. We have an existing longer-term Scottish Widows investment product, which we will be looking to, you know, attach to PRS investment opportunities. In terms of the bank market itself, and particularly on the development finance side of things, you know, the investment market is much more liquid. I mean, you've seen that most recently, I think, with the 20 Leadenhall building and the banks that stepped up to do that and the amount of banks they were bidding for that. The development market is much tighter. You know, we feel we have a market-leading position in that insofar that, you know, we are fairly expert at what we do, and we've got a good reputation in it. That enables us to actually talk to other banks through our loan markets team, and they will partner with us to provide additional liquidity and also additional heft, if you like, in terms of amount. So if an opportunity comes to us for a development financing, yeah, and the ask is 200 million and our capacity is 100 million, then our job is to bring in those other parties to again deliver the product to our client who can then take it forward. And there are a number of examples of that. You know, we partnered with Wells Fargo, for example. Okay, that was on side by side, but we led the deal, structured the deal on the select student accommodation side of things. We are currently working on another transaction where we'll be bringing in three other new lender names. So, you know, the liquidity is there. You have to obviously source it. But in sourcing it, you've got to make sure that if your reputation's on this transaction, they've got to be the right sort of transactions.
Yeah, if I could just add, I think, you know, there's definitely an appetite there from the sovereign wealths, from the pension funds, the ultra-high net worths. But there are still barriers to entry. One of the features of alternatives, or almost one of the defining factors about alternative sectors, is that they have to be operated. And, you know, you can't, it's not a commodity. You have to have skill and expertise in the management of these assets rather than it just being about bricks and mortar and off it goes. And therefore, the barriers to entry for some of these pension funds and particularly the overseas sovereign wealth and so on are much higher than for just getting an agent's report on an office block and investing in that. We have seen, although student housing has moved along that sort of stability curve to now being almost, and I hate saying almost, slightly mature, and you say that and people start running away from the sector thinking it's about to, you know, dive. But actually there is an element of maturity there, of stability. Mm. And then we've got other sectors, some of the healthcare elements and self-storage and data centres, which are gradually moving along that conveyor belt towards a degree of more stability and being recognised. But the barriers to entry will remain there. If we are going to do a transaction on a major portfolio, let's say 500 million plus, with a sovereign wealth or with a major overseas pension player, and if it's their first transaction in student, as is very often the case, there is quite an element of risk associated in closing that transaction. And so we have this situation where a lot of those players are actually teaming up with partners who have operational expertise and who have perhaps the capability of providing pipeline. And so it's not just about who's the capital out there, it's also this matchmaking of, you know, in some cases it's the consolidators working with the pension funds. We had thought a few years ago it would be predominantly a move from private equity having dominated in the early years and then moving on to the cheaper pension fund money. Actually, you look at the actual buyers over the last two or three years, private equity is still very, very active in the sector and continues to be. And most of those pension buyers, as I say, are teaming up, making strategic partnerships. But it's still challenging to get, let's say, a KIC or someone like that from the Far East to make an investment in student housing. In reality, if we're selling a big portfolio, there are only a very limited number of parties who are capable in terms of understanding direct let risk, because that's, you know, it's fine if you've got a lease to a university, that's just a standard pension product, no-brainer. Yeah. But if it's direct let, they've got to understand the sector. And so I think, you know, one of the ongoing roles for those agents and for those others who are involved and the developers has been helping or trying to help educate the markets about, you know, how these, what the risks are and what sort of returns should be, how student housing is operated, and I'm sure likewise how health senior living facilities, how they should be run and what sort of expectations they should have.
Yeah,
makes it more interesting though.
Indeed. Well, picking up on something you said, Philip, which is pretty close to my heart at BLP, is that one of the things that strikes us is what all these businesses have in common is, as you say, they are operational businesses. They all have beds that yield income. And so do you think that we might see a sort of a divergence? You've talked about the fact that some of your student operators are moving into build to rent. Do you think that we might, as the market evolves, becomes more stable, that we might see much more of a divergence with investors who were traditionally student looking at build to rent and vice versa? And dare I say it, Nigel, you know, people might well step into your world of retirement living and care homes too.
If I can start on sure. Respond to that. There is an essential difference at the moment with the retirement housing market, because everything we build, we sell. There isn't really in existence in the private sector a rental model within our sector. And it is the creation of that rental model that will actually, I think, unlock massive expansion in the sector, because that's where investors, and in particular institutional investors, will be able to deploy capital using their low cost of capital effectively. So it's difficult to compare the retirement sector with the student housing sector, because we're a bit of a muddle. And I put that in this way. When we go to gear up our balance sheet, we go and see a bank, we will typically have seven people sitting the other side of the table. We'll have our relationship manager, and the bank will have brought along two people from their property lending department, two people from their healthcare department, and two people from their corporate department, because they don't know where the hell to put us. And that this reflects the infancy of the retirement housing market. Now, that's changing rapidly, because people are waking up to the fact there's huge demand, has got to be satisfied. But it's exciting, because it's still an industry that's in its infancy. I believe that the business will actually split into operators and investors who'll take the property income streams. That is a view that's not necessarily shared by some of our colleagues. We simply don't know yet how this business is going to develop, but it is very exciting to be in on the ground floor of something that's going to be huge.
The student housing market in France is quite like the senior living market. Most student rooms, when they're built, are sold off individually. And they've got just starting a bit of a revolution, another one in France, where they are actually hanging on to whole buildings now and building up portfolios. So we're seeing a similar process there. You mentioned the collective, though, as an interesting example, where you have sort of the student lifestyle, students living, and you also have young professionals and the like. We're selling the Old Oak one as joint agents at the moment. And, you know, we see that very much as the way things are going to go in the future. Very few student developer operators that I'm talking to are not champing at the bit to take the obvious step and move from just student housing to young professionals housing. Some of them tried it early on. It didn't quite work. There are planning issues, VAT recovery issues, council tax issues, a whole host of things that make it slightly complex. But I think it's the future. And also add to that, those people who have got assets in central London and where the asset might be let to a student perhaps for 44 weeks are looking very carefully at the Airbnb-type market now, which is obviously maturing very rapidly in terms of the way in which they utilise those beds over the summer period. So I think we're seeing a whole load of new areas coming in, but I totally agree. I think that's what we'll see is a divergence.
I think it is interesting then, because you do still have, obviously, PRS BTR is a nascent market. I mean, I think the Knight Frank stats are 20 billion invested now, expect 70 billion invested by 2022. The student market is still actually very, very fragmented. And this is where I think there is an awful lot of opportunity for greater consolidation. But as those operators are in there, they will start to line stretch. We're certainly seeing it with one of our clients who has a very strong brand and is looking to take that brand development into the PRS space. I also think there's an important part about delivery here. I mean, there is an awful lot of capital being put to use and wants to be put to use and wants to be invested. It's how that, if you like, the stock itself is actually put together and delivered. Now, it does, you know, it is exciting that there's lots of good conversations going on, but how that actually gets facilitated is important too, because developers will want to make a return on this, and therefore they will they'll need to buy the land at a decent value. They'll also need to ensure they can work up the land suitably, enable it. That's where I think government can help. I mean, certainly with the Woodwharf development, we saw the HCA stepping up and providing an infrastructure and enabling loan. And you guys are on the other side of that, of course. enabling loan. And we have seen that elsewhere too. And that's actually very, very powerful for the delivery of this product to meet the housing need, which is pressing. So I think the money is there. It's more about facilitation. Mm.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. I'm really conscious of time, and we ought to open this discussion up to the floor, and hopefully we haven't bored everyone to sleep. So please, by all means, if people have got questions for the panel, feel free to ask.
We don't want to linger.
Sorry, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, thank you.
You mentioned that the retirement living model is based on a sales model as opposed to a rental model. What do you think needs to change to shift that model to a retirement?
It's simply a supply of finance, but don't be too hard on the operators, because why do something difficult when you can do something easy? We're building these flats, houses, and we're selling them and making money and moving on. So it's the time will come when it will be appropriate to start developing the rental model simply by competitive pressures. We did find an institutional investor who agreed to take and to fund our rental units, but we had to first put them into parcels of 50 million quid at a time. Well, as a small private company, we simply haven't got 50 million quid to warehouse that number of units. So it needs money to come into the sector. It needs operators with deeper pockets who can then afford, who don't need to sell the units to turn the cash over to go into the next development.
Do you think there's a shift in the public in terms of their appetite for a rental product?
Candidly, I don't know. I mean, we always say in this country, our culture is to buy, compared to France, for example, where they're much more of a rental culture. But if you think of my children's generation, I've got three children living and working in London who rent because their father's too mean to buy them a house. culture changes, things will change. So we simply don't know. If you take the social housing sector, where far from, unlike private housing for retired people, where we haven't scratched the surface, on the social housing side, funded by the state, we lead the world. I mean, the operators have done a fantastic job, and that's completely based on a rental model. So it will come. I think long term, it has to come. But I'm not, in my own mind, quite clear how we get there. I'd say this, though. If we had the capital, we would start building rental blocks tomorrow. I'm that confident to have a go at it.
Oh, hi there, Richard Lemon from the planning team at CBRE. Is the panel comfortable that the planning system and planning policy is sufficiently responsive and receptive to these various alternative asset classes we've been discussing this morning?
Do you want me to have a look at that?
No.
And if so, why not?
Well, no, I can only give the client view and what we hear from the clients. And some clients are actually saying it's not broke, don't fix it. Others are saying the opposite. And frequently what is pointed to, however, by the clients is, if you like, a lack of investment in the planning departments and a lack of bodies in the planning departments actually holds back the development.
I mean, just picking up on that we've actually got a lot of research that we've sort of commissioned with operators in this industry, and there is a real keenness given demographic changes. There is a shift towards renting. It isn't just a multi-generation rent. It applies to people sort of in their late 30s and early 40s because, you know, there isn't a concept of a job for life now. People are moving globally. They don't want to be tied down by property. And so given there's an appetite that is undeniable for a move into the rental model and there are synergies in these alternative asset markets, it is felt quite strongly that in the UK, one of the biggest barriers is the planning system. The fact that there are such distinct sort of categories of this usage and actually being able to transcend that is pretty tough at the moment.
Space standards that are applied to what are, you know, very different types of residential accommodation, which are different to the norm. And my view certainly is that the planning system hasn't quite caught up with all these different types of development.
Can I agree with you completely? Our village is a C2 use class. We have no affordable housing requirement. But whenever we submit a planning application, every single time we have to reinvent the wheel to persuade a local planning authority that's the case because there's no clarity. And we either need a special use class for retirement housing or we need some sort of ministerial note coming out just to clarify the situation. The other thing, I agree completely about the lack of resource in planning departments. In virtually every planning application, it's deferred. It just takes months to get these planning applications through, and it drives you potty, frankly.
My particular gripe on the student housing side isn't necessarily just about the planning, although I find that incredibly frustrating. It's more about that whole panoply of other things like community infrastructure levy and so on, which means it's almost impossible to develop in central London at a time when market conditions are making it tough enough anyhow. Plus the sort of NIMBYism about student housing at a time when houses in multiple occupation are in relatively scarce supply. Every new student block can free up students from a house in multiple occupation, and yet you still get people talking about studentification and other things like that. And also because students historically, you know, they don't pay council tax, so they're not so popular amongst some of the officers. One can get quite cynical about it. But it's tough enough trying to develop in central London student. That's why most people have been having to go out to the Wembleys of this world and Stratford and so on to find more affordable land to enable it to still be viable.
Hi there, it's a question for retirement living. How important is branding to retirement villages, especially attracting people to the city?
Well, I happen to think it's very important, but I would say that, wouldn't I? We do find that our customers, and in particular their children, visit two or three of our other villages before they commit to living in one of our villages. And that raises an interesting point, because we were talking earlier on about the difficulty of finding some sort of vanilla income stream to invest in from retirement housing. There is the opportunity there, I think, to split the branding from the property assets in the same way as the hotel sector has done, by letting us operators do what we do well, which is operate under management agreements for investors. Now, that has not happened yet at all, but it's a personal hunch of mine that that might be a way that we could encourage more money into the sector.
Question for the for Nigel. Nigel, how important to your business model are the event fees?
They're very important. I'm very relieved somebody's mentioned event fees, because it's the elephant in the room for retirement housing. Event fees are what sometimes are called exit fees, transfer fees, deferred management fees. They're a fee that is paid typically when the property is resold. And that fee in this country is typically between 10 and 15%. The highest operator, Lifecare Residences, charges 30% in this country. In overseas markets, the fees are much higher, typically around 50%. And this fee is an integral part of the income flow that comes from what we do, and which we were able to borrow money against once upon a time, until the OFT interfered in our sector in 2009, first of all by coming to an agreement with McCarthy and Stone over some alleged malpractice, and then at the end of 2009 they launched an inquiry into 28 operators, of which we were one. That published in 2013 inconclusively. The Law Commission has now launched an inquiry, which reported earlier this year, and has said basically these event fees are absolutely fine, provided they're transparent, and they've created a statutory code, and we're waiting now for that to go through into legislation. Gavin Barwell, the Housing Minister, was about to announce this, I understand, at our Trade Association conference, but the general election came along, and we've only just had a new Housing Minister appointed. So we might miss the 1st of October date for this legislation that we were all aiming for, and it might now not be until 1st of April next year. But once that legislation is enacted, then we will be able to borrow against these assignment fees. And that's reflected in the fact that in my own business, our core funding, our gearing, is only about 6 to 7% of asset value, because our principal asset, this income stream from event fees, at the moment, no bank will lend on it. And that's just about to change, and that will unlock. If I can just go on. With our own business, we expanded from 3 villages to 12 villages between 2005-2009, when the OFT report started. We haven't really expanded. So we've added 2 villages. One we bought out of administration, and another doesn't have any event fees since then. It's crippled the sector, and it has to be sorted out.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. I think we are officially out of time. So if you'd all please join me to thank our panel, I'd be most grateful.